So good afternoon, everyone. We're going to go a little out of order here. We're going to start off with a public hearing on 1045, and then a public hearing on Senate Bill 851, and then the cost allocation study, transportation cost allocation study. We're not going to vote out any legislation today. So let me open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1045. Jamie, could you give us an overview?
Thank you, Chair Haas, members of the committee. If you might remember, Senate Bill 1045 is a bill that proposes a property tax exemption for individuals that join a home share program to low-income individuals who are called home seekers. And since we heard the bill in public hearing, the proponents of the bill, Department of Revenue, and some other groups have worked together to discuss sideboards. So we're going to pull up a little table that we have on OLIS so that you can quickly see that a maximum amount of property tax exemptions that would be available under the amendments and exemptions that and sideboards that we're working on. So total, if Isaac can zoom in a little bit, the major sideboards that have happened, so we have the exemption is a reduction from the assessed value not to exceed $300,000 for the value of the property, and that would be adjusted to inflation. And the home seeker's income must be below 60% of the median area income, so they must be truly low income. Family members don't apply, don't qualify as home seekers. And it also limits the participation to 500 properties, and those properties would be allocated by the relative population size of the jurisdiction. And it also doesn't allow property tax exemption stacking under this program. So those are the current sideboards that are working through. And then way down at the bottom of this table, if you had all those 500 properties that were eligible and they all received the maximum amount of reduction, the total impact would be 2.5 million statewide. And so we also have from Senator Riley -1 amendment, which would exclude school districts and community college and special education districts from this bill, and that's about where we are.
Okay. I need binoculars to read your numbers up there.
I apologize.
So, what? But we don't have amendments quite ready to go. Phil Donovan, could you come up and update things from your perspective?
I guess I'm going now, since I'm by myself. Members of the committee, thank you. Phil Donovan here on behalf of Harbor of Hope. Pleased to be here in support of Senate Bill 1045. And let me start off by just the last week, since we've had our public hearing with you, we've been very engaged. And I'm going to use names, Mark in Department of Revenue, Eric with the assessors, Jamie in Legislative Revenue, Wendy with LOC, Alan Dale in Legislative Council, who's taken a whole lot of different ideas and collaborated with us to develop a discussion draft that we think is ready to go, and I think it's just literally making its way through the paperwork process. Much of the amendments are pretty technical in nature, and I can touch on a few of those. But let me start by sharing what you saw up there, which is something that Jamie kind of flagged for us. She said, wow, this is a really innovative, good idea, and it could be taken across the landscape of Oregon, and you could get, you know, we could see thousands and thousands of Oregonians sign up for this and local jurisdictions. And I appreciated that enthusiasm, but we were like, yeah, but we're just talking to a few jurisdictions and we're hoping to get some participation. And so as to not get ginormous numbers up on that screen, And to provide some certainty to you all, you know, we basically, it doesn't say pilot project, but we've boiled this down and put some pretty stringent caps on it, you know, 500 homes in that first year. And, you know, of course, that'd be 1,000 over 2 years. And then, you know, the cap on the assessed value so that we know exactly it's not going to break the bank, if you will.
So she was optimistic on this bill.
Yes.
And looking forward, and you crushed your dreams with this amendment.
Sir, you put me in an awkward spot because we did love the enthusiasm and thought process, but I didn't want to see huge numbers up there just yet. You know, we sort of want to prove the model, if you will, show that it can work, make it work with fidelity. So, yeah, and then we'll come back to you and we'll lift the cap and we'll work closely with Jamie to do that. You know, but here's the thing is when we put that cap into place and all of a sudden it got really like, okay, well, how do you monitor to make sure that you don't have a whole bunch of signups? Like, you know, happened with some energy tax credits one time, long time ago. So we then, and this is where Alan and Mark get an A for effort, you know, we had to figure out like, okay, so a local jurisdiction says, I'm interested. And then they notify Department of Revenue, and the Department of Revenue has a little bit of time to say, okay, who is interested? Okay, Marion County, you know, we had Jimmy Jones from Marion County here last time, and we had Laura from Northwest Pilot Project, you know, in Multnomah County. So say those two jurisdictions said, we want to sign up for this. So then Department of Revenue would be like, okay, well, 250, you know, go forth, do good. Let's show how this works over the next couple of years. So all of that had to be scripted out and written into the amendments, and that took some time to figure out. Also in that vein of technical stuff, you know, the Department of Revenue and the assessors were clear that breaking up tax scheme districts who do and do not participate is a bureaucratic nightmare. So the bill that we had originally introduced would have allowed that scenario that you envisioned, Senator Riley, with your amendment. But we got scolded pretty hard that is very difficult to implement. And so the amendment says you got to get to 51%, and then the abatement applies across the board. You know, you also saw in there, we're clear that adult children living at home may not be classified by their parents as homeless. And thereby getting a property tax abatement for their slacker kid.
I'd like to give one to homeless.
Some of the other things were, you know, we changed shall make rules to may make rules. Anyways, I won't bore you with that stuff. But point being is it took a lot of thought. I know you all have afforded yourselves to hear from us while we've been working on this. We've appreciated your feedback. And that's sort of the status of where we're at.
Okay. Appreciate that. We'll look forward to the amendments. Senator Bocas?
No, down there.
Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Hassel. I just want to go back to when you said about the definition of homeless. Can you just talk a little bit more about that, of what was in the bill? Because there are, I'm not sure exactly what terminology is used, but there is a very, very important homeless count that occurs.
Sure.
So how does that work?
No home seeker has to be at 60% of area median income. That's what's in the bill. But what I think is really important is that there's also language that was suggested by Wendy at the League of Oregon Cities, mm-hmm. that basically says a local jurisdiction could lower that threshold. So they could make it harder to house populations. But 60%, you know, Ryan in my shop's sort of the affordable housing guru, and he says, mm-hmm. that's what you see pretty much across the board throughout Oregon revised statute is affordable housing.
Okay, follow-up? Thank you, Chair Hassan. I guess I wasn't very clear. So when you were using the example of a younger person, a family couldn't say, well, they're homeless, and therefore they're paying rent and staying here, but would they meet that definition of homeless anyway? I mean, you're saying if there's a third, it's just excludes family member.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with being young or homeless. That was just just clarifying.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Phil.
Thank you.
Eric Kanslet.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, Eric Kanzler, representing the Oregon State Association of County Assessors. I'll be fairly brief in my remarks. We engaged with the proponents of this bill several weeks ago with some technical concerns about how the bill would be administered. I have to say that over the past few weeks, they have, near as I can tell, accepted every recommendation, every change that we needed to make sure that we could administer the bill cleanly, which is really our only lens. On legislation like this, we don't take policy positions or really comment on the policy angles, but we are fine with this bill moving forward. It looks technically sound. We do have to respectfully oppose the dash one in light of the difficulty of administering that sort of change. It would effectively ask us to create a new taxing district for every property. If there are questions about that, I have a couple assessors here that could provide answers.
Thank you, Eric. Let's bring up these three people signed up: Jody Weiser, Marcia Kelly, and Chris Vogel.
Senator Haas and members of the committee, Jody Weiser speaking for Taxpayers Oregon. We really like the dash one amendment to this bill. And it would require somebody write a computer program so that you could figure out what the taxes are for each property, but I don't think that that would be terribly difficult because you would be exempting the same things, the property taxes that are going to education in each property. And so I'm pretty sure that people who can create things like Facebook could create a simple program to make it possible to use the dash one amendments. And we definitely are in support of those. The state has much of the responsibility for funding education, particularly K-12. But also community colleges. Approximately 45% of property tax revenue is education related, as you can see from the chart that they was provided by staff. Despite that fact, in 1990, when Measure 5 took effect, the legislature since then has passed 45 new property tax breaks, the total cost of which in this coming biennium is $838 million. Of that $838 million, approximately $380 is education funding. We can't continue to do this. This is part of why we're in the situation we're in. It makes little sense to be raising $2 billion for education funding with one hand and giving it away with a new property tax break with the other hand. Even if education dollars are removed from the dash one, with the dash one amendment, the bill has numerous flaws. We just started seeing the amendment, so we can't really speak specifically to all the things in the amendment. But that limitation that at $300,000 means that I would get $5,000, roughly, because I rented a space to somebody, and it might be somebody who was low income, or it might be somebody, and there's still, I can't see anything that says what is the measure of affordability. So is it 30%? That should be in the bill. Is it 40%? A lot of poor people, if you read the Book of Evicted, are spending like 88% of their income on housing costs. And so that really needs to be clear in the bill what you want. In the TFO committee, if you said 25% of the cost of the property taxes could be exempted rather than all of the property taxes could be exempted, because of the difference in property taxes on assessed values, some people would get, one person would get $3,250. And another would get $440 if they were renting their room to a low-income person. That's a huge variation because of the way our property tax system is, and it seems like an awkward incentive. It might be better to just say, we'll give you $1,000 off your property taxes. But then you wonder, why don't we just have a grant program that gives $1,000 if you try renting your house to someone? But it isn't that sharing a living space is a new idea. It's moved from bunk houses and rooming houses that were all advertised on bulletin boards and by word of mouth to Craigslist and now to multiple rooms for rent websites. There are hundreds of homes with shared spaces available through multiple home share websites today. In Portland, there is Trulia, Roomba, Bungalow, Kangaroom, Spare Room, Roomies, Find Roommate, Indian Roommates, and Roomster with Portland listings. Silvernest does have two listings in Portland. They certainly don't stand alone. And while the advocates say that, and their own website says they focus on seniors, probably that's why their name, their average age is 40 of the people who are renting places. Homeshare isn't new. It's been happening forever without a property tax break, and we see nothing in this bill that would keep owners who are currently renting a room or two to becoming the benefactors of the program. They would just need to go to the service and say, I'm really willing to take a roommate, and oh, and I have my roommate already found, and they would get the benefit. There's also nothing, it's an 8-year long program, but there's no reporting to the gathering of information that is required so that we would actually have a way of evaluating whether it was successful, whether people who had never rented and had a roommate before started doing so because of the program. But it's also like a foot in the door. If you do this for 500 people this year and 4,000 people 10 years from now.
Jody, we need you to summarize.
What's gonna happen to all the other people who are low income and think they should be getting the same benefit? Will they not be asking for that to be broadened?
Chair Haas, Vice Chair Benson, members of the committee, Marsha Kelly for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. I won't say anything that's already been said. I will say that we believe that 60% of median income is too high. 50% of median income would be $34,400 in the Portland area. Since we haven't seen the amendments, or just recently saw the amendments, there should be a standard period for the time that the home share does not have a home seeker, and we would suggest that as 3 months. I can't see giving away property tax for somebody who gets someone for 3 months and then maybe doesn't find anybody for 9 months. It's unclear who is going to be determining some of the things that are in the bill. How do you evaluate by reason of a breach of the home share agreement for which the home share provider is not at fault? So are you going to get mediators to figure out whether the home share person is not at fault if they lose their home share? That's going to be costly. It does not, apparently they put in relatives, but that would not exclude domestic partners. And how do the assessors know to immediately disqualify a program? Are they going to have to go out and knock on doors and make sure that the home share agreement is still going? It seems like it is a problem waiting for a solution, but this may not be the solution. I suggest that the county administrators are going to have more administration with this program than a normal property tax program. And those property taxes that would be abated will not contribute anything to the administration of the program or the jurisdiction's other unfunded liabilities, such as PERS.
Chair, Senators. I'm Christine Vogel with the League of Women Voters. Today I'm channeling Madna Roll, who is our revenue person, and Debbie Iona, who looks at housing. Greatly appreciate the work that Phil Donovan and company has done to put some significant sideboards on this in the amendment as it's described. We haven't had an opportunity to completely review that yet. In my testimony, I'll just call attention to the last paragraph. There is currently a mortgage interest deduction bill that sits in your counterpart in House revenue. If that alternative were considered as a place to provide credit, there's already a section in there dealing with long-term rental assistance vouchers and case management for recipients of long-term rental assistance vouchers. That bill could be easily modified to incorporate the aspects that are also considered in this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for testimony.
Thank you.
Close out the public hearing on Senate Bill 1045. We're going to briefly check in with 851 before we get to the transportation study. So I'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 851. This is the easy to understand, straightforward business of guilty. And let's pick up where we left off. We have some new testimony in the OLIS meeting materials, as well as an update to where we left off last time, Kate.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, so I'll provide kind of a quick update. I'm still working on the revenue impact statement. The fiscal was minimal, and I brought an example to work through with the RIS that should be on OLIS. In regards to the questions that were raised last time, I'm trying to get a concrete answer on the water's edge issue and whether this is a violation. Currently, where I am with that is that these corporations, so a water's edge question would determine which corporations are part of a unitary group. And so this wouldn't affect apportionment, but could affect federal taxable income. And so trying to understand that still. And following up on that, also trying to better understand the interaction of guilty with other provisions of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. There was a question last time about map patterns and why some states do things differently than others. I'm working on compiling a list of states that are most similar to Oregon in terms of things like combined reporting or separate reporting, Joyce Finnegan, Water's Edge, et cetera, so that we can look at what just those states did. And so then briefly, I'll go through kind of an example, preliminary, only for illustrative purposes, not a formal revenue impact. But what I have here is to give you an idea of what data we're working with. The second row here, the one that says federal guilty amount including 50% deduction, this is the form of the data that we can access from the Federal Joint Committee on Taxation. So I have a number, or there are numbers out there, but it includes the 50% deduction. So the next row, which is the full federal guilty amount, not with that deduction, would be twice the amount of the first row, whatever that might be. So that's how I get to the $16 billion in this example. I have an asterisk there because there's also things related to foreign taxes paid tax credits, and I haven't accounted for that yet. There's still some uncertainty with the federal numbers that I'm looking at. If I were to take Oregon's portion of that federal number, whatever it might be, that we usually share about 1.5% of the federal number. That's the example here of $240 million. So for the revenue impact, really what we're looking at is taking a federal number and trying to make it comparable to Oregon. The amount that Oregon taxes of that amount, of that $240 in this example, is still up for question because that's a policy call on how the legislature, or in the absence of statute, how DOR would treat this income. So that's where things are now, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Where we last left this, we were going to get an amendment to do a couple of things. Where are we on that?
So we have an amendment. I'm in talks with Department of Revenue. I think there might be some language issues, so we're just trying to clarify language before moving forward.
Okay, and that would do what?
Well, that's part of the language issue. So I think the amendment So currently what the bill does is it takes the amounts that were deducted from guilty, so that 50% deduction, and it requires an add back. And then the implication of where this is included in statute is that then the 80% dividends received deduction is included. I believe the intent of the amendment was to not allow that 80% and instead allow maybe the federal deduction, but that's what we're trying to figure out still.
Senator Benz.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions. The first one was, we were asking how much we lost, if that's the right word for it, on the tax haven repeal bill.
Oh, okay.
And then the second question was, how, in your hypothetical, does that low tax jurisdiction fit on the federal side of things? I think they, there's a third, I want to say it's 13%, where they, the federal government still manages that differently. I don't know if that's up, I don't think that's up here.
No, I don't think it is.
So it'd be nice to see how that factors
okay,
in.
Okay, sure.
Thank you.
And again, our two, I guess, hopes here, if there's any consensus, is one, to clarify things, and two, to choose the appropriate policy direction that's in line with what other states are doing or what, you know.
Okay.
And so that's, I think, I don't want to say the word consensus, but I think that's what we were hoping to get in
the amendment.
In the amendment.
Okay, got it.
Okay. Any other questions, Senator
Boquist? I just want to clarify Senator Benz's question, because it would be helpful to understand when it gets to the policy thing. Because in the previous tax haven bill, which you were not here for, but you have to go to research, when Senator Benz said the loss, the assumption had been, or the political sales job of getting rid of the tax haven is that this money is automatically going to show up somewhere in the guilty formula. And if you can figure out where that, because it's all reportable now, previously it was not reportable, now it's a 100% reportable under the federal law, and so it should show up someplace in the guilty calculation. And if you can figure out maybe where it used to be, because we were making them do it, and where it shows up now under this whole guilty formula, it would be helpful then from a policy so we can understand whether it's, you know, half of the deduction, or it's part of it that's hidden, or it's part of the 80% after the DRD, or just sort of where that plugs in.
Sure, absolutely.
Because that would certainly come down to the bottom. We're trying to figure out what's the best way to do it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay. I'll close out the public hearing on Senate Bill 851. And let's sit back for a moment and do our annual biannual highway cost allocation study. Mazen, you and your team?
You don't. That's the problem.
Okay.
Yeah.
Afternoon, Senator Haas, members of the committee. Mazen Malik with Legislative Revenue Office, and I know you're at the edge of your seats waiting for this study to come, but you allowed everybody else the chance to go away. I'm filling in also for our consultant, who unfortunately is having an operation today. And the highway cost allocation study we bring to you every biennium, and we try to put you in the picture of what we've been doing with this constitutional requirement, and just to not to go any further before I turn it to Mark McMillan, who's our state economist and who also chairs the study review team of the highway cost allocation, that he would go through first couple slides, and then we'll let you know how the process and where the results is. I'll come back and talk to you about it.
Yeah, thanks. For the record, Senator Haas, Vice Chair Benz, Mark McMullen, Oregon State Economist, and Chair of the Highway Cost Allocation Study Review Team. What does this, you know, we're here to report back on this constitutional requirement that we have, and what the highway cost allocation study does is it tries to make sure it's equitable in terms of the amount of revenue generated by vehicles of different weight classes, the light vehicles versus the heavy vehicles. Is that proportional to the costs on the roadways that they incur, and the cost is defined by the types of expenditures that are put forth in the highways during a given biennium. So in Oregon, this is the state of the art for this sort of thing, for the cost allocation studies, because we've been doing it for such a long time and have, relative to a lot of other states, given the importance that people have put on it by enshrining it in the Constitution. This will be the 21st study, and the first being done by Condi McCulloch, the famed bridge engineer who did all the nice bridges on the coast for us, or most of them. And so really what this is about is we look at this equity, we see if the amount being put in by different weight classes is proportional to their the cost that they're putting on the roadways, and then if not, we recommend that the legislature act to ensure that. And so this is all about the process, and what we do is we hire a consultant, Echo Northwest, to do the study, but then we hand in hand through every step of the way vet it with stakeholders. And Mazin has put up our current study review team for this biennium, who really dig in. It's a very detailed, technical, not exactly exciting, but there are a lot of, you know, important assumptions there for stakeholders, and they do have quite a bit of skin in the game. And so they really do analyze every step of the way the consultants work and provide feedback for that. Here you see we have most of the major stakeholders, the cars, the trucks, the counties, the bikes, and the like. And we're also get some help from academic world with Don Negri from Willamette University, who's very special to us because he's been around so long with us for several rounds now and has a lot of that institutional knowledge. On this study review team group, we've had a generational shift here over the last few years where we've lost our participants who have been with us for many years. The main consultant we lost the representative for the counties, for the trucks and the cars all at once. And so Professor Negri's institutional knowledge is very, very useful. So the most important thing about this process is that it's transparent and that the stakeholders feel that they've had their concerns recognized. And so with that, we're going to bring up a few members of the study review team to talk about the process, and then come back and Mazin will quickly give you the results of this biennium study.
Good afternoon, Chair Haas, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm here today on behalf of AAA Oregon Idaho. Riveting, dazzling, exciting are words that have never been used to describe the Highway Cost Allocation Study Work Group. And this is one of the responsibilities, now that I'm representing AAA, that I've had cause to curse my brother, who did this for over a 20-year period.
He abandoned you.
Yes. The first day I arrived and sat in this meeting, I thought, I'm never going to figure this out. So it is, first of all, very complex. And it is important to have people that have experience and institutional knowledge to make sure this process works smoothly. So I spent a lot of time really trying to get up to speed on this. And we have some fantastic people that are a part of this process, including our state economists, including Mazin Malik, you heard from both of them a minute ago, Professor Negri, and a host of other folks, including ODOT and other players, including Eco Northwest, that go through a very detailed process. There's a lot of science, and there's a lot of important detail here. There's also some art associated with it. As I came to understand it a little bit better, I wanted to say that the confidence that we have in this is very important. And as the two ratepayers and road users between Mr. Buchan and the Oregon Trucking Association and myself representing AAA, it is very important that we get this right, and we share that, and we share the confidence in the process and the end result that you're going to hear about in a few minutes. When I started to try to figure out what actually is going on in this process, it's really this simple. The users are going to pay revenue into this process, whether it's cars or trucks. We need to figure out how to responsibly divide that cost between cars and trucks for expenditures that are going to occur in the next biennium. That's the bottom line. It's done through allocators. Responsibility can vary, and I'll give you a couple quick examples. For the car side, there's some things that are exclusively car responsibility. Studded tire damage, for instance. And to get at that future biennium, just because there may be $40 million of studded tire damage in our state on roads, that's not the important number. The important number is what are we going to spend revenue on related to studded tire damage. Cars are 100% of that responsibility. For trucks, it may be weigh stations. That's an exclusively truck responsibility. And then there's some that are shared among all of us. For instance, the signage we depend on, sign maintenance, and the things that whether you're a car or a truck, you depend on those things. So the cost responsibility in a very detailed fashion, I made it simplistic, but there's a ton of allocators for all kinds of things. It's all done scientifically to come up with that cost responsibility between the payers. And so with that brief introduction, I want to say I appreciate all the patience that the experienced member of this work group showed to me as I was trying to come up to speed. And then I think I'll turn it over now to my partner with the Oregon Trucking Association, Waylon Buchan, to take it from there.
Good afternoon, Chair Haas, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Waylon Buchan, and I represent the Oregon Trucking Association. Thank you, Kevin, for the great foundation that you laid. I will say that this study is absolutely a beast. It is one of the most complex and nuanced studies you'll probably ever participate in or see, transportation or otherwise. But it's really important, and it's really unique to the state of Oregon. A lot of other states do highway cost allocation studies. They have for 70 years, just like we have. But we're unique in the sense that we have a constitutional mandate to actually balance the books, which is actually your job. We bring this back to you and say, here's what we found. Cars and trucks pay in this proportion to the damage they do on the roads. And if they need to adjust it, that's the obligation of the state legislature. Not all states do that. Some folks kind of do the study, and then they put it on a shelf where it kind of collects dust. So I'll say that the impetus behind this study, the importance behind this study, is heightened in Oregon, and it's backed by our Constitution. So participation in this is absolutely vital. And that's where Kevin and I come in as ratepayers. We participate in this, and I almost liken our participation to similar to a courtroom, where you have two different sides zealously advocating for their positions, and somewhere in the middle of that is probably where the truth can be found. And the associated staff, you have Echo Northwest, you have DAS, the Office of Economic Analysis, you have ODOT, and you have a strong cast of characters, Don, of course, who help orchestrate this process as we are advocating from our two zealous positions. You get somewhere, you find that truth in the middle. And so what do? We probe, we ask questions, we stare at giant walls of numbers, and if a decimal point looks off, we challenge it right away. And they, to their credit, dutifully go run down the answers for us, sometimes with long, long, complex replies, which almost, pretty much always satisfy us. So it's a very important process. I will say that a couple of things we want to highlight going forward as a piece of constructive analysis for this study is that we will note that there's always been a little bit of a gray spot in the medium-duty truck category where you have 26,000 pound or above are sort of my represented folks for the most part. Those are the weight mile taxpaying group. You have the lighter category that Mr. Campbell represents. And then we kind of have this middle category that we don't always exactly know how they behave in our state. And so I think that one of our challenges is to dive deeper and understand how those, you know, cooperate and participate in our system and how we quantify them. And another issue we noted in this study and a trend that we've noticed over previous studies is the local road share of damage associated with heavy trucks and light vehicles. And while heavy trucks run a very small proportion of their mileage on local roads like cities and counties, we do see the number and the responsibility going up over time. So that's something we want to challenge the group to continue to dive down in. And we've gotten assurances from the group that they're working diligently to continue analyzing this. We also did a white paper recently on cap and trade, where we asked and answered two questions. One, can the study handle cap and trade if it were to pass? Do we know what to do with these revenues at all? And the answer was yes. Second question was, well, what happens if we raise a whole bunch of revenue and how do we treat it? Can we still use the study to, quote, you know, balance the books between the two ratepayers using this new different color of money? And again, the answer was yes. We have those tools and we know how to do that. That's kind of where the analysis mostly stopped, but we did ask and answer two pretty important questions on that piece. I think with that, I want to turn it over to Don. And if you have any questions, I'll point you to the certified smart people in the room. And again, I thank you for your time.
Good afternoon. My name is Don Negri, and I'm professor of economics at Willamette University. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on the study review team's deliberations. I will be very brief. I have served on 7 Oregon Highway Cost Allocation Study Review Teams, including the most recent. The study review team reviews the contractor's analysis, and it's made up of diverse set of stakeholders, including the gentleman on my right, the state economist, interested citizens, independent experts, ODOT administrators and staff, academics like myself. The study review team scrutinizes, as everyone has said thus far, every step of the process, including the model assumptions, the data, and the results. As our team members can and do request revisions and clarifications, and there have been many, the contractor has been quite responsive to the study review team's suggestions, recommendations, and requests for information. The outcome of this process, a broad-based process, is a process that has integrity and produces an analysis and set of recommendations that I would personally characterize as objective. I have been quite impressed with both the civility of the discussion and the degree to which these gentlemen on my right advocate for their constituents and at the same time come to an agreement on what they see as good data and at least objective data. So I think that's pretty much my role here. Okay. Any questions?
I think we're ready to go.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Okay, and again, Chair Hess. Mark, would you?
Okay, yeah. So, Chair Hess, member of the committee, I won't belabor it. What we do, the white papers were mentioned. That's the only thing that, what in addition to the main study, we do. Given the process, the stakeholders have found it very useful to try to be forward looking in some of the policies that transportation policies that and revenue policies that the legislature is looking at to try to get ahead of it. And as was mentioned, we did some stuff on trucks on local roads as well as a cap and trade paper this round. So. This round is a little bit, you know, special, and I'll pass it on to Mazen for that, insofar as for most of my experience with the study, it hasn't changed much. The equity ratios that he'll talk about have been pretty close to equitable, and so we haven't requested that the legislature do anything to change rates over several recent rounds. This time around, that wasn't the case. The numbers moved quite a bit, but at the same time, we don't recommend any action right away because the reason a lot of these rates changed so much was because of the institution of House Bill 2017, which changed rates for both cars and trucks and did so over several biennia. And this study really just looks at the current biennia. And for the current biennia, some of those fees for the heavy trucks were front-loaded in the highway plan. And so going forward, we expect, all else equal, things to move back towards equity. And I'll let Mazen give the details.
Well, thank you. Again, for the record, Mazen Malik, Legislative Revenue Office and Senator Hess and members of the committee. Just quickly to put you in a very high level, we know that the we take our expenditures, planned expenditures, and we see what is revenue forecast. We put these things on top of each other. And if the ratio is one, there is perfect equity. Everybody is paying what they should. If it's less, of course, they're paying less. And if it's higher than one, they're overpaying. So three main things in the big complexity that everybody described, but there is on the top, there is three main things that we look at for the model. First is the vehicle miles of travel. And vehicle miles of travel that we have it in detail as to go to the each segment of highway and each lane of each segment of highway. We take that and we see how that divides between heavy and light and how much they put and drive actually VMT. This is our VMT forecast for the coming year, which is 2020, the base year for the highway cost allocation study for this biennium is calendar year 2020. And our forecast basically says we have 37.3 billion miles of travel or vehicle miles of travel in Oregon. And then once we have that established by highway segments and so on, we go and find the expenditures that is forecasted by the agency budget and the agency program. So that agency has a STIP, or State Transportation Improvement Program, that plans 4 years ahead for each project on each highway that is expected to be built. We take those and we take then other costs from the budget, such as administration costs and other types of overhead. And we becomes the our second input into the model. And this is how it basically looks of how we expend the amounts that we get in the budget. There is about $2.1 billion that we allocate. And you could see that there is about 6.2% increase in expenditure from the 2017 study, and that 6.2% primarily reflective of all the new stuff that we spend on. And these are the different categories. And the other category includes all kinds of other stuff. This is DMV and motor carrier and all types of planning and so on in Department of Transportation. And here's your maintenance, preservation, and bridge that we actually look at their expenditures. And the third input into the model is the revenue forecast. The revenue forecast that comes from also from ODOT for the coming 2 years, and it assumes current law and current law instruments and rates. So for this study, you have two increases that was done by House Bill 2017. We had the first increase in 2018 and the second increase in 2020. So that what was included in this forecast. And the projected annual revenue for the biennium, of course, but it's an annual, it's a $1.5 billion. And of course, these revenues come in different flavors. And as you could see, fuel tax still remains to be the lion's share of revenues that we get in the transportation arena. But you could see that there are changes now in the registration fee amounts and weight mile tax, because that was one of the instruments that House Bill 2017 used extensively. So there are issues that also are dealt with. in a highway cost allocation study, we do have things that we don't pay for themselves, categories of vehicles, and those categories of vehicles are the either subsidized or they pay on a different schedule. For example, your government vehicles are primarily subsidized because they don't pay as much into the system as they should, or not as they should, because it becomes a circular taxation otherwise. So they are subsidized. And however, there are also subsidized vehicles such as transit vehicles. We do subsidize the work of transit vehicles. And there are the alternative fee. Those are flat fees and other types of payments that could be done instead or in lieu of. So we bought all these things at the end, and then you get, as you see, the expenditures in the blue and the revenues in the red, and that's what the light and heavy and the total find. And you could see that the expenditures are primarily a lot higher than what the revenue comes in. And the reason for that, of course, is that we include in the expenditures all the amounts in the program that is covered by or paid for by the federal government and some local governments. So we take that total expenditures and we work that between the classes. We take the total revenue coming from the class, which is slightly less, and then we adjust them accordingly through all that machinations of model. We just put this to make it understandable. And these are basically, you see the three diamonds, that's where the major things and the inputs that come. So so you have the user fees, the cost responsibility, and those other expenditures and the revenues, and the VMT, that's the three main inputs that we have. And then we get to the equity ratios. And you see that the declared weight of 1 to 10,000, this is your basic vehicles. Your basic vehicles are paying at 0.985, and this is less than 1, which means they're underpaying their responsibility and this time around. However, you see that the different classes, you know, paying at different types, and the amounts, or the category that Waylon talked about, the unknown or the squishy, not very well understood categories, the 10,000 to 26,000, and we have it at 1.0. So in general, what our conclusions came at this time is that the light vehicles are projected to underpay the responsibility by about 1.54%, and the heavy vehicles are projected to overpay the responsibility by about 3.14%. So that's a light vehicle ratio of 0.98. And in general, we use these two general ideas or split between the two. So basically the costs or the cost ratio between the heavy and light is 67.2 and 32. So two-thirds, one-third approximately. Between the light is responsible for two-thirds of the cost, and the heavy is for about 32.8, which is 33%, one-third of the cost. If this was before House Bill 2017, if this was the 2017 biennium, we would have a recommendation of adjusting those rates. However, because of House Bill 2017, as Mark mentioned, what we have done in that bill, and I'm sure some of you lived that agony for a while, what we've done in the increases in the heavy vehicles is that when we increased them, we increased it at the highest amount of increase at 54% at the beginning of the package. So that was at the request of the industry. So we pushed it to a 54% immediately in order to allow for the heavy vehicles to carry on credit through the 5 biennia or the 10-year time for implementation for House Bill 2017, which, of course, would reflect itself in the heavy vehicles, showing that an overpayment for that amount. Now, the light vehicles are gonna come more, especially in 2020, 22, and 24. This is when we institute the highest level of registration fees. Those registration fees are tiered by MPGs. So we expect it all to catch up to where they should be. So in other words, the balance within the five biennia that we've established in House Bill 2017 will reflect itself in the coming couple biennials to come, and the best is yet to come in that sense. So that's our results to you and what we want to bring to your attention at this time, and why that is not, we don't see necessarily a required urgency for the adjustments to take place at this time.
I would have thought there would have been, I don't know, more action somewhere because of the 2017 change, but still too early, it sounds like.
Yes, you have, you know, the full implementation biennium is 2025-27. So until 2025-27, you don't have House Bill 2017 completely implemented. So we have still 2020 to increase, and then 2022 and 2024. These were the increases occurred at different times. So that we expect it to adjust those differences back to what it should be. It has been the case before.
Senator Benz, Mr. Transportation.
This is actually the second time I've seen this. So I ask a multitude of questions the last time around.
Okay.
Maybe I didn't. I can't remember. Silence. I just appreciate all your work. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, sir. And we hope you feel better soon.
You know, I feel great. Sound bad, but feel great. Thank you.
Senator Taylor?
I am good. I was on the Transportation Committee as well. I understand the general sense of this. Thank you.
We're glad we had the chance to give it to you twice, so now you have for sure kind of thing.
Thank you,
gentlemen.
Thank you.
All right, we close out another week in the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue. We are going to not meet tomorrow, of course. We're not going to meet Monday, and we're not going to meet Tuesday. But the following Friday, I believe that's the 10th, we're going to fire up for the first time the Tax Expenditure Committee, of which you are all members. I think we'll aim for 8:30.
On Friday the 10th.
Green Room A?
Same place, same time. Or different time. The other committee meets at that time. Yeah.
Okay. We will adjourn.